During my graduate studies at Michigan, my main area of interest has been the ideology of early American foreign relations. I have decided to focus my dissertation, which is about halfway done, on the thought of Tom Paine, primarily because no one person figures more prominently in the ideology of early American foreign relations than he. According to Felix Gilbert, for a long time after the publication of Common Sense in 1776, as Gilbert put it, every utterance on foreign policy starts with Paine's words and echoes his thoughts. Other distinguished historians in this field have echoed Gilbert's words, including Bradford Perkins, who's my advisor, and Sir Michael Howard. Paine is also quite interesting because not only was he an important figure in the shaping of elite ideology, which diplomatic historians have traditionally examined, he was also very important in shaping the ideas of ordinary people. The Crisis, Common Sense, and Rights of Man, the latter two arguably the most momentous publications of the age, were written primarily to influence the way ordinary persons thought about international relations and war. In spite of his significance in early American history, historians concerned with early American ideology have yet to explore adequately his involvement in and views on international relations. His biographers have not been trained in diplomatic history, and they have not been aware of the questions germane to the field. Since most of his political life and writings involved international relations, this is a serious gap in the literature, and this aspect of his life deserves a book in itself. My article in the journal Diplomatic History on James Hudson, Felix Gilbert, and Paine surveys some of Paine's themes, but it, along with today's presentation, is only an introduction to Paine on international relations. The most important thing to remember about Paine was that he was not a philosopher or any kind of original thinker. He was a journalist, a public intellectual. He drew upon several strands of thought current at the time to promote concrete objectives. In my dissertation, I argue that Paine drew upon four different yet related ideological strands common during the period, namely republicanism, liberalism, Christianity, and populism. Defining the first one, republicanism, is difficult, and I must express my great sympathy for John Adams, who in the early 19th century confessed that he never understood what republicanism was and thought that no other man ever did or ever will. In spite of this, a lot of historians have spent their time trying to define it. Historians have associated it with civic humanism, classical republicanism, and more, even a particular ideal of motherhood.
Could you pour one?
Paine's republicanism, in my opinion, was closest to what is usually called country republicanism, with a capital C. In English political terminology, the label country dates back to at least the 14th century. James Hudson notes that by the 17th century, it had acquired its basic meaning of, as he puts it, opposition to the exercise of power by governments. The country persuasion opposed the so-called court persuasion. Court persuasion favored mercantilism, continental alliances, executive power, and the development of new centralized financial instruments associated with the chartering of the Bank of England. The court persuasion dominated England after the financial revolution of the 1690s. But in America, country sentiments dominated, and most court sentiments left with the loyalists. There are exceptions, of course, such as Hamilton. Now, there's a common misperception about the country perspective, and that is that it's hostile to international commerce. This is not true. As Stanley Elkins and Eric McKittrick have showed, it was not commerce in general that the founders abhorred, but instead the, quote, alliance of government, finance, and standing army, and the luxuries and corruption emerging from that alliance, specifically, not commerce in general, which that the country persuasion opposed. It feared not foreign commerce in general, but instead an, quote, unholy alliance of commerce, manufacturing, money, and public credit, fostered by an intrusive and interfering government. It also opposed, among other things, in the realm of foreign policy, large permanent diplomatic and military establishments, mercantilism, entangling alliances, and the financial centralization encouraged by war and great power politics. It favored free trade, especially in agriculture, economic and territorial expansion, autonomy in foreign relations, the separation of financial and governmental power, and a preference for militia over large and permanent military establishments. For Paine, equally important to country republicanism was his liberalism. Liberals viewed the individual as a bearer of inalienable individual rights to be protected by private property, contract, the rule of law, and a limited government checked by a written or customary constitution, as well as popular sovereignty and an internal division of power within government. Liberal ideas about individual rights, individual autonomy, and limited government corresponded, I think, to foreign policy ideas that preferred private and international trade over mercantilism, national autonomy over entangling alliances, and suspicion towards, once again, large military establishments. Under the larger heading of liberalism, we must also consider Scottish moral philosophy, especially its concern with patterns of social growth and decay. And some of you might be familiar with this from the works of Drew McCoy. Although Americans favored agricultural abundance and rapid population growth, many feared that abundance and growth would hasten their culture's inevitable decline. Population growth could lead to urbanization and the moral degeneracy that they associated with urban life. And it could also create a large and landless white population, dependent on others and therefore unfit for Republican citizenship. A solution to this problem was a foreign policy based on territorial expansion. In the same way, agricultural abundance could lead to idleness, the root of moral decline. Hard work could be encouraged and idleness avoided by the desire for manufactured goods. However, since the manufacturing stage of development entailed landlessness and urbanization, the development of domestic manufacturing promised, once again, degeneracy. A solution to that problem was a foreign policy based on vigorous agricultural export that would keep the corrupting influences of industrialization overseas. Such arguments appear throughout Paine's writings on international relations. Another influence on Paine was Christianity. His American writings quote scriptural authors more than secular ones, and his longest single argument in common sense is based on the book of Samuel, in which Paine asserts that the Bible shows that God dislikes kings and that disaster befalls their subjects. Bear with me. This is in the American context, not the French one. His writings also make great use of Protestant anti-Catholicism, as he often accused his enemies of popish plots, Jesuitical schemes. And my favorite is when he condemns his opponents as attempting to transubstantiate liberty into slavery. Christian thought was at the root of both his insistence that Americans were a chosen people and his universalistic transnational belief that all people are entitled by God to human rights. I also think that Christian millennialism can be linked to both Paine's isolationism and his internationalism. Pre-millennialists believed that Christ would return before the millennial age to usher in the 1,000 years of peace. Skeptical and inward-looking, they assumed that the world was corrupt and unsuited to improvement without the direct intervention of Christ. Therefore, isolation was in order. Post-millennialism, which was the dominant form of millennialism in the late 18th century, and also mainly the form that Paine looked towards, held that Christ would return after Christians had spread the gospel throughout the world and transformed the world, And I think that there are connections between this optimistic and outward-looking belief in Paine's foreign relations internationalism. Lastly is Paine's populism. This can be seen in his belief that humankind could be grouped into two distinct classes. The first entity, which Paine labeled society, consisted of what he called the productive classes, which included laborers, farmers, artisans, small merchants, and manufacturers not holding government-chartered monopolies. The second entity, which Paine labeled the state, consisted of what he referred to as the plundering classes, those who used state power to live off the productive classes through high taxation. Paine's time, this minority included many government officials, standing armies, blue water navies, aristocrats, established clergy, and holders of government-chartered monopolies. As Paine put it, the dynamic of history was the struggle between these two classes of men in the nation, those who pay taxes and those who receive and live upon them, the struggle for supremacy between society and state. In Paine's view, much warfare was essentially this class struggle, if you will, writ large. In part, war was an attempt by the plundering classes to increase revenue through the conquest of territories containing exploitable productive classes. In addition, it was an attempt by the plundering classes to distract their own productive classes from the abuses of the state. For war served, as he put it, to prevent people from looking into the defects and abuses of government. Government encouraged national chauvinism, he claimed, because it will have no excuse for its enormous revenue and taxation, except to the degree that it can prove that, somewhere or another, it has enemies. Most importantly, war was an attempt by the plundering classes to increase taxation in the territories already under their control by creating a crisis in which national humiliation or annihilation might result from resistance to tax increases. Excuse me. Paine asserted that, quote, war is the common harvest of all those who participate in the division and expenditure of public money in all countries. It is the art of conquering at home. The object of it is an increase in revenue, and as revenue cannot be increased without taxes, a pretense must be made for the expenditures. In other words, as he put it, taxes were not raised to carry on wars. Wars were raised to carry on taxes. The plundering classes who live on taxation promote war to raise revenue. In contrast to the plundering classes, war harms the productive classes because, as he put it, they must all pay towards the expense of war and gain none of the benefits. Successful wars of conquest do not lessen taxes. On the contrary, society is, quote, taxed to pay for the charge of making them. And has not that been the same in the case of every war? The plundering classes, Paine believed, quote, fatten on the folly of one country and the spoils of another, and, between their plunder and their prey, may go home rich. But the case is very different with the laboring farmer, the working tradesman, and the necessitous poor in England, the sweat of whose brow goes day after day to feed in prodigality and sloth, the army that plunders the productive classes on all sides of international conflicts. The plundering classes' thirst for taxation, according to Paine, meant that near-continuous warfare was the fate of any society dominated by the state. All four ideological strands, country republicanism, liberalism, Christianity, and populism, emphasized the dangers of excessive governmental power. Christians held that there was a higher law than that of governments. Liberals feared government powerful enough to subvert individual rights. Populists assumed that the powerful state would be the tool of elites, and the country persuasion was based on opposition to strong, centralized government power. All of them saw war as the main engine of despotic governments, as the main engine of political corruption and the proliferation of placemen, standing armies, and high central taxation. For Paine, these traditions informed his view that foreign policy should be cautious. America should avoid entangling alliances, steer clear of European politics, and concentrate solely on the territorial defense of the United States and, under some cases, the West as a whole. They also shaped his internationalist belief that ultimately the security and prosperity of the United States and the good of the entire world rested on the spread and eventual worldwide triumph of liberal republicanism, which some commentators now call democratic capitalism. He believed that the mainspring of foreign policy should be the desire to preserve domestic liberty through the pursuit of peace and private trade in a dangerous world where war and mercantilism were the norm. Not peace just because he was idealistic, or peace just because war was costly, but peace precisely because he believed that war created excessive governmental power, and that excessive power would destroy liberty as he understood it. Thank you.